Hi guys. So today I'm going to be talking about the IO infusion, also known as intraosseous infusion, and the placement and central lines and CVAD. I was surprised when I saw central lines and CVP on my fiance's syllabus. That's a little advanced, to be honest with you, but I assume they're gonna probably like not spend so much time on it, but it is a subject that's pretty interesting and it can get pretty in depth pretty quickly. So I would definitely like clarify if you see something like this on your syllabus, I would clarify exactly how in depth they're gonna go when it comes to central lines because it is a lot. So we're gonna start with IOs because that's super common among the paramedic population. Like when you learn about this, typically, this is like in a code setting or like a critical care setting, and it's usually like to serve as an advanced life support skill guideline for like an IO infusion. So typically, you would try a line before this. Different protocols say different things, but you would try to get an IV into this patient first. Absolutely. I would say a few times before something like this. The indications for something like this would be for adult and pediatric patients who are unable to successfully get an IV or who need administration of a medication for cardiac arrest. Patients who have like immediate life-saving need, like a very critical situation. So some like an example of that would be like status epilepticus when they're like just seizing uncontrollably. You need to fix that. And if you can't get a line because they're shaking and you can't get a line or their perfusion's off because obviously they're not that blood flow is not happening the same way as it would if they were nor if they were like in a normal state and not having seizures. So it might be hard to get peripheral access on this patient. So you might have no choice but to put in an IO to be able to deliver the medication the patient needs to survive. So and in trauma patients, when they need fluids, like you need to overload them with fluids because of the amount of blood loss that they have gotten. Obviously, this is pre-hospital, not in hospital, so you don't have blood products on a truck. So you have your different types of like salines, which I'm gonna get into in another video and what each of them do, because I am more than certain that you're gonna be tested on something like that. And each of them have different indications. So I'm going to do that in a separate video because it's a topic of its own. But in a situation where you have somebody that's in a trauma, you need to get fluids in them now. So that's another indication for something like this. If you can't get an IV and the patient needs fluids, you need to put an IO in them. And when indicated by protocols, a good example of something like this would be a pediatric code. And I know most protocols, if you have tried once to get an IV and you can't get one, you go right to the IO. Some skip the IV and go right to the IO if the patient's an infant. It depends. Pay attention to your own protocols, pay attention to your own rules. But typically, this is something that happens in a really critical life threatening situation. This is not just like a patient who's awake, alert, oriented, and their perfusion fine and all that. No, this is a patient that needs your help. So there, if you don't do this, they will die. That's typically what this procedure is indicated for. So some contraindications for something like this, and I would pay attention to this when you're given a scenario, especially with the theme of trauma. If you're simultaneously going through trauma as well when you're learning this, would be a recent fracture in the involved bone. Do not put an IO in a fractured bone. I mean, that could be harder than what it sounds because sometimes you don't know if a bone is broken. If the patient has had a lot of injuries and they've been in MVC and they have all these broken bones, but they're all closed fractures, nothing that is like indicative of like a it's like a non-displaced fracture where it's like there's no deformity to the limb, like how are you going to know? And they're like, they're circling the drain on you and you need an IV. Like, how do you know that that bone is not broken? Well, obviously there's no x-ray in an ambulance. And that's more of like, if you see a bone sticking out, don't try to put an IO in it. I mean, it's pretty obvious. I don't think that I need to explain that so much. Infection of the site or selected, like that you select for insertion. Somebody has some type of infection of the leg. If they're like a diabetic and they have poor wound healing and it's like their leg looks pretty funky, like don't put it in that leg. Choose the other leg. Excessive tissue at insertion site. You know, you can get that in your heavier patients. Their legs are, will be a little bit more stumpy. Or patients with heart failure where they have dependent edema. That's pretty hard to choose. But I mean, at that point, it's kind of like life over limb. Like what, or you can choose another spot and we'll get into that. Any type of previous like significant orthopedic procedures in that insertion area. So I've heard stories of like when somebody puts in an IO, they hit a pin or they hit a stent or something that was put in that person's bone at a, as a prior surgery, like earlier in their life. That's not your fault. You don't know, like, you know, chances are you weren't able to get a thorough medical history before this patient became unresponsive. So, you know, that's kind of like a, if you see a scar on the surface of the skin, maybe don't go there. Maybe go on the other leg. And a previous IO within 48 hours on that same extremity. That's more of like in hospital. Like that's not so much pre-hospital care. Any type of special precautions when it comes to an IO? IO lines will not be established as like precautionary. Only patients who have an immediate need for an IO medication who are like do not have vascular access, peripheral venous access, can and you can't obtain it. Like you have tried a lot of times and you cannot get an IV, then they will go to an IO. You know, that comes from the whole like least invasive to most invasive. I mean, I think this is pretty self-explanatory. And the people around you, obviously, whomever you're working with will agree, like, you know, let's try another IV first before we try this IO, that type of situation. Typically these require like an order from your medical director, or they're part of your standing orders, or if you're working on like a three-man or two-man truck, like whomever is in charge, like your captain or your lieutenant will go ahead and say, okay, we can do this now. Like, so this is not something that you just like decide on your own, hey, I'm gonna do. Like, this is like a team effort and this is a serious invasive procedure. So this equipment can, it can vary depending on where you work, but typically it's called an easy IO driver. I've worked in pediatrics, so I've only seen like the pediatric version of it, but they have it for adults. And, the easy IO adult comes in 15 millimeters, 25 millimeters, 45 millimeter needles, some type of antiseptic solution. You want to make this as clean as possible. Nothing is going to be sterile in the back of a truck, although we would love for it to be, but, we need to make this as clean as possible because we're going into bone. And if an infection happens in their bone, now we're just introducing a whole new host of problems to this patient who's already in trouble. A 10 ml syringe, normal saline, or some type of suitable sterile fluid, a pressure bag or infusion pump. You'll get that question a lot. What do you do to the blood pressure? What do you do to the saline bag when you're hanging infusion to be infused through an IO? Typically, like the old school way is going to be put a blood pressure cuff around the saline bag and pump it until like it's pretty tight. But they have pressure bags that come with this, and infusion pumps, they don't really exist in the back of an ambulance, so that's more of like a critical care paramedic type of thing. But typically a BP cuff will do. You put it around, you pump it up a little bit. Even the hospital, we do it sometimes. The simplest way is the best. An EZO stabilizer, obviously, whenever you put something in, you got to stabilize it. Same thing with an IV. You put an IV and you're not going to let it dangle there, right? You got to tape it up. You put some tape over it. You put, you know, you secure it onto the patient's arm. The same thing with this. You have to secure it onto the patient. The procedure, typically, you gather all your equipment, you gather your gloves, you fill the syringe with normal saline, and you keep the needle tip sterile. Always, do not touch it. You locate an approximate insertion site, which I will get to in like about 2 minutes. You prepare the site, position the patient so that the site is accessible. You scrub and make sure that the insertion site is clean, and you prepare the EZ-IO driver and appropriate needle. And then now I'm going to get into like the location, because this is a test question, and this is also something you have to verbalize whenever you do this in lab testing. Anything that is non-traumatized, that's your number one. You want to hit that point. Proximal tibia. Locate the insertion site, medial tibial tuberosity. It's about 2 finger breadths below the patella. So you find patella, that's the knee, and about 2 fingers, maybe 3 if you got small fingers, on the anteromedial flat bony surface of the proximal tibia. So you might have to Google that, because that's, I mean, I can understand that reading that, but I understand. Like, you might have, like, your 2 fingers are probably as big as my 4 fingers, so it just depends. Non-traumatized humerus. You can do this in the humerus, so, like, for that patient that has problems with dependent edema and it doesn't look so great, you can probably go to the humerus. Anything that is adult, like for an adult, a distal tibia, anything, when we're talking about adults, we're talking about 15 and older. Same goes for trauma. Trauma is 15 and older. And that goes in the hospital too, pretty basically every hospital. Any patient, like for example, where I work, it's a pediatric trauma center. If they're 15, they're treated as an adult. We don't treat them anymore. When it comes to trauma, when it comes to like medical stuff, we still treat them. But so when I say adult, just for reference, and any of this, like when I'm talking about this, it's anybody who's 15 years and older. So don't get scared if like your lab instructor gives you a 17-year-old female and you're like, oh my God, they're a pediatric. Not really. They're basically an adult. So, you know, they've already had the secondary characteristics of puberty. They look and they act like an adult, like physically. So they can be treated as such. So that's for the location. Those things, like, it's hard to, like, explain over, like, voice only, but those I've always had to Google. That's something that you're never going to, like, remember off the top of your head. You have to remember it for your exam and for the national, but it's, like, when you're working, like, you're always going to have somebody there with you to kind of, like, show you, like, where you need to go. And I've always just remembered medial tibial tuberosity. And I've always remembered where that was on myself. So that's just like, you can commit one to memory and you can never be wrong with your response. Kind of like what I said last video about picking the 25 gauge needle for sub Q and IM. You pick one that applies for both and you run with it. Whenever somebody asks you something, you're never wrong. So that's a good way to like not get points docked off in your like lab testing. So the needle sets, they're by kilogram. So some things in medicine are by kilogram only, and this is one of them. Typically in your pediatric population, everything is by weight, but this is by weight. So your patients that are 3 to 39 kilograms, those are your children mostly, they're 15 millimeters and they're pink. This is like a universal color. 25 millimeters are typically blue, they're 40 keys or greater. 45 millimeters are yellow, patients that are greater than 40 kilograms with excessive tissue or placement of the humeral head. So if you're going to do a humerus IO, it's going to be 45 automatically. Doesn't matter what, how much they weigh. Now you need to have some common sense with this. You can't put a 45 millimeter in somebody who weighs 3 kilograms. You're going to have to put it in the medial tibial tuberosity for somebody that age because they need the 15 millimeter one. So use your discretion when it comes to something like that. 45 millimeter, for example, would be somebody in heart failure, has dependent edema, somebody with bilateral like femur fractures, like somebody with bilateral tibial fractures, like that sucks. So like we need to choose somewhere else. And those patients that are more than 40 kilograms. So basically, if you look around in your class, anybody that's in there will probably fall under blue and yellow. 25 and 45, because most of the people around you are going to be more than 40 kilograms, and most of the people around you have excessive tissue, they have a lot of muscles, or they have, they're a little chubby. Most people in like the United States fall into that category. So when you're looking at your patient demographics of what you're going to choose, you can go ahead and like safely say 25 and 45 are like, you know, what it's going to be most of the time. So for you to go ahead and insert the appropriate IO needle, you have to stabilize the site and insert the appropriate needle set. So like what we were just talking about, remove the easy IO driver from the needle set while stabilizing the catheter hub, and then remove the stylet from the catheter. You have to dispose of the stylet in the sharps container. Do not put it on the table next to you. Do not put it in front of you. Do not put it next to you where you're sitting. You have to put it in the sharps container. That is an automatic fail. And I'm sure that you know that from ENT. And then you attach the prime site of the port extension. Now, when I did this, I would clean the IO hub first and then connect it. I'm pretty sure you won't fail because of that. But I'm pretty sure that it's not like something that if you don't do, you'll fail. But like if you clean it and you don't fail, like might as well just clean it. So clean the IO hub and connect it. And remember that port extension set for port extension set has to be primed. Can't put air into the IO site. After the IO site has been placed, what do we do whenever we place something? We make sure we confirm. Attempt to confirm the IO placement by aspirating a small amount of bone marrow. So this is tricky because usually in your lab testing, as long as you demonstrate that you tried to get some type of bone marrow return by aspirating, they'll pass you. Because sometimes in real life, you may not get a return because that's just the way that it is. Like some people just don't give you return. I've seen it in person. I've seen kids give tons of return, and I've seen kids give like not a lot of return. So you flush the IO needle with 10 mLs of normal saline in an adult and 5 mLs for a pediatric or neonate. So with any type of like, when they're conscious, this might be a little bit like going in too much for this. Like this might be a little bit too in-depth, but you can look into pain management for them if they're awake, alert, and oriented. Now, to be honest with you, for your scenarios in paramedic school, I very much doubt that they're going to give you somebody that's alert and oriented that needs an IO needle. So some special notes about this that I made was the preferred site for infusion is always the peripheral vein. I cannot stress that enough. Your first site that you want is always an IV site before an IO attempt is considered. This is, you have to make sure that like the peripheral sites are not available and that there is no other pre-existing venous access site. If there's a central line, a PICC line, a tunneled catheter available, those things will be documented in the PCR, the patient care report, whatever you make. But remember, like those things can be accessed for something like this in an emergency situation. So like if you're given permission to do so, if it's in your scope of practice. So if you have another way to access this patient, use that way instead of making a new access where you can introduce any type of infection or like a whole new host of like problems for this patient. This is also pretty important. You can always mention this and like, you know, this kind of like shows that you know what you're talking about. But there will only be one attempt per extremity when you have an IO infusion. You cannot attempt more than two total attempts for an IO. That means if you try on one leg, you try on the other, that's it, you're done. You should never delay the time that you're on scene for an IO. Your priority is to get this patient to the hospital to transfer care. You should not delay that transfer of care for an IO. Because typically in the hospital, you have a physician who does IOs all the time, and he will be able, or she will be able to do it. Generally, you make one attempt at the scene. This is what I wrote, and this is what I've gathered by like reading and remembering. Usually you make one attempt at the scene for an IO, and then a second en route. And then if you deviate at all from one attempt on the scene, like if you attempted twice while on the scene, you have to document the reason why. And that's just another way for you to like cover yourself just in case something happens, to make sure that you show that you did everything that you could for this person. So now I'm going to go to central lines. This is not going to be like super in depth because this can get like ridiculous. Like in nursing school, this was so long and so like ridiculous. And I really don't think that they're going to do this to you. If they do, like, please tell me and I'll go back over it and I'll explain it as painful as it is. But I'm just being dramatic. It's really not that painful. It's just a lot of information, honestly. And it's just a lot to know for something that you don't really use that often, especially people in pre-hospital care. And nurses too, like nurses really only use this if they're like in critical care or something. I'm talking about the CVPs, like the pressuring, like to the pressure monitoring. You don't really use that so much unless you're in critical care. So central lines are used for IV nutrition, like TPN, chemo, long periods of IV antibiotic therapy. You got to discharge somebody. They need IV meds all the time. So they get a central line because an IV only stays good for so long. You can have like infection and things like that. And like I said, you can use a central line for central venous pressure monitoring. That's a CVP that I keep talking about. So the location for a central line is in the lower third of the superior vena cava. There's no way that you can remember that. You just have to commit it to memory. You need a consent before you insert this. So if you insert this, you need a consent. Paramedics don't insert this. And then a RN can only put in a PICC line. Everything else has to be done by a physician. The biggest thing that I think that will be like taught when it comes to paramedic school would be like the hand hygiene and being clean before you do this. You have to wear a mask and you have to remain sterile the entire time. Now, what I ask myself is, why is this on a syllabus when you don't have sterility in a truck? There is like no form of sterility in a truck. You only have clean. So if you guys don't know what sterile is, like you literally have to put these special gloves on. You have to put them on special and then you can't touch anything until you touch the patient. And then after you touch the patient, you can't break sterility because everything has to be in your point of view. That's very hard to do in the back of a truck. I really don't see like why you would do this in the back of a truck, but it's on my fiance's syllabus. So I thought I'd go over it, and it is an in-depth subject. So like if, you know, if he tells me that there's a lot of information on this on his test or something, like I'm going to be really curious to see what it's like. So, and then the other thing that I think that they're going to talk about in paramedic school would be like prior to accessing the hubs, like if you want to give medication through it, how long do you scrub the port? It's usually 15 seconds, not minutes. You scrub the ports for 15 seconds. And that's pretty much it. I don't have anything else when it comes to that. It is a sterile procedure. You use the 10 mls of saline to flush weekly. I would say like if you're gonna put any type of medication into this, you give the 10 mls of saline before, make sure that it's good before you use it. And then scrub the hub, put the 10 mls of saline, and then scrub it again, and then put the medication that you need to put. If you are allowed to access their central lines, I don't think paramedics are, but it's on the syllabus, so I'm going to go ahead and say that they are. So that's pretty much like a little synopsis of what central lines are like indicated for, and like their location, and what are some like, you know, paramedic interventions that you need to think about or anything like that. And that's pretty much it on IO. So I covered those two topics. If you guys have any questions, you guys can always ask me. And good luck, guys.